This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in June.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Simon Tolkien about his novel The Palace at the End of the Sea, in which a young man comes of age and crosses continents in search of an identity and a cause at the dawn of the Spanish Civil War. We'll also talk about part two of this historical saga, The Room of Lost Steps, which continues the story of an American boy with impossible dreams who's thrust into the cauldron of the Spanish Civil War. Simon Tolkien is author previously of No Man's Land, Orders from Berlin, The King of Diamonds, The Inheritance, and Final Witness. He studied modern history at Trinity College, Oxford, went on to become a London barrister specializing in criminal defense, and he's the grandson of J.R.R. Tolkien. He's the director of the Tolkien Estate. In 2022, he was named as series consultant to the Amazon TV series The Rings of Power. Lives with his wife, vintage fashion author Tracy Tolkien, and their two children, Nicholas and Anna, in Southern California. A pleasure, Simon Tolkien, to welcome you back to Access Utah. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me on, Tom. It's a great honor, privilege. Thank you.
We talked several years ago about No Man's Land, and I guess in intervening years, you've been working on these books.
Yeah, I guess it was a long time ago, Tom. I don't know how long, 8 or 9 years. And off and on, I've been pretty intensively working on these two books, I suppose beginning in the fall of 2016. So it seems like a very long time ago and a very long time since I've been on the radio as well. So,
all right. Good to have you on. And you're speaking to me, from Santa Barbara, where you've lived for several years.
Santa Barbara, California. I emigrated here in 2008-09. So I've lived here near on 17 years. So I'm an American, all naturalized. And with these books, I wanted to write about a book for the first time about an American,
which
is
yes.
Challenging if you're a British person.
Right.
used to thinking in British ways and speaking in the British language. And it's funny how many differences there actually are between British and American, which I'm just completely unaware of. And when the book was copy edited this last year, they came up with so many examples of where Theo, the hero, is actually talking British. He should be talking American. And you can research things like baseball and New York in the 20s, but there's no real kind of way over that. So I'm very grateful to my publishers for doing the final part of turning him into an American.
Why did you want to come to America? And I'm curious about, was there culture shock?
No. My wife's American.
Ah, okay.
Way in. And we kind of had one of those deals that she was going to live in England for a while. And then we were going to move over to America. And we kind of delayed it. So we were 25 years in England. But to be honest with you, I just really prefer it here. I don't know. I think in England, I was always felt kind of a little illegitimate and uncomfortable. I don't know why. Maybe it sort of comes out of my childhood and adolescence, which wasn't enormously successful, which is the reason I write coming of age books, I suppose. But I'm very, very happy and comfortable in America. And I like America. And I like the way the whole system works without getting into politics, you know, that it's for the people instead of for the Queen. So, I guess I'm really happy here.
I wanted to talk about a little bit more about your background and your relationship with your grandfather, your grandparents. Specifically, you have said that you had this desire to become a writer, but perfectly understandable that you felt overshadowed by your grandfather, you know, Lord of the Rings. But that changed about the time that Peter Jackson's films started coming out, which seems like an odd time for that to change and you to launch into writing your own books.
Right. I think, I don't know what you feel, Tom, but if you look back over your life and you see the kind of different directions you've gone, then you've got the huge advantage of hindsight to be able to say this happened because of that, but that isn't nevertheless necessarily right. I didn't have a desire to write. Actually, to be honest with you, I think I must have self-consciously but the reason I didn't is because I was absolutely certain I couldn't. I was very self-conscious. So the idea that I would be able to write words which just flowed, which is what you need in order to write fiction, because otherwise people are going to be, he's thinking and they're not going to be able to absorb themselves in the story, seemed to me to be completely impossible. And I think, again, with hindsight, that quite obviously the fact that my grandfather wrote one of the, great books of the 20th century with a great deal of flowing prose, made that more difficult. And overshadowed me. As regards to the whole Peter Jackson thing, I think that it was a catalyst. I think it was the idea that I didn't want to just be the grandson of J.R.R. Tolkien, which was nothing against my grandfather. I always got on really well with my grandfather, and I've always liked the books, but I felt it affected my identity, and I wanted to have an identity of my own. And that's why I started writing. But I think it was a catalyst because I think the desire to write, as I'd grown in confidence, and being a barrister in England made me much more confident, the writing did start to flow, albeit that the writing journey was a kind of slow burn and slow development. So I think it was more a catalyst. And then the writing desire, which was in me, kind of boiled out in a kind of volcano kind of way. Bit of a bad image, but you know what I mean.
Right. Now, imagine this could have gone a different way. You could have, having this at first subconscious desire and then a conscious desire to write. You could have maybe had a jaundiced view toward the Lord of the Rings, but that wasn't the case, right? You loved the books.
It was never, ever any problem in relation because when I grew up in rather a good way in relation to my grandfather, because he died when I was 14, and my parents got divorced when I was four, I think. And so he retired when I was about 7 or 8, down to a town called Bournemouth on the south coast of England, which is a kind of retirement community. It's not Florida in terms of the temperature, I can promise you, but it's by the English Channel. And because my grandmother had arthritis, it was difficult for her to be at home. They'd bought a house down there, so they were in a hotel. And I would go and stay with them in the hotel a couple of times a year. And it was great because we spent a lot of time together. And this is very vivid in my memory. What's funny, though, is that the hotel, when I was small, seemed so huge. It seemed like the Ritz by the sea. But then when I went back with my aunt as an adult, it was really small. It was just like a little seafront hotel, which was funny. But we did a lot of, things that you do with your grandchildren. We played huge word games where he'd come up with a long, long word, and I can still see him, coming up there and looking over at me and saying, when we were doing Constantinople, he said, "But you've forgotten the word silo." These kind of crazy little things. And I guess I remember it because I loved the show recently. These kind of little things like stick in your head. And I loved The Lord of the Rings. I was a precocious reader from early on, and I read The Lord of the Rings when I was 9. And so I got to like talk to him about it. And I was talking to him about things like, who are the Blue Wizards? I'm sure you don't know who they are, but Tom, but these kind of questions. And it was a lot of fun. So I look back on those days as a, particularly as I was a bit lost and moving around. And I really enjoyed my time with him. And I feel a very strong bond to him. And I think that reinforces the work that I do with the Tolkien estate, because I feel I'm working for him as well. So that's great. So the whole thing with my grandfather and the Lord of the Rings, it's always been really good. And I love the book.
There's one little image I just want to mention, and then move forward. You wrote a piece remembering your grandfather. I'll just quote this. You say, "I still have a tiny farthing coin in which he had managed to fit the entirety of the Lord's Prayer and Ave Maria in his teeny distinctive handwriting." It's a little image. I guess you still have the coin.
Yes, they do. It's extraordinary, and I think it shows his extraordinary care that you see in his paintings. There's this wonderful art that he did in relation to the burnt book or the Book of Mazabul that the dwarves find when they go through Moria in The Lord of the Rings, which records what happens when Balin tried to go back and reestablish the kingdom of Moria and was overwhelmed by the orcs and the Balrog deep down. And it's that sense, and he actually burnt the leaves of the book that he had made slightly so that it would have that same kind of verisimilitude, so it would be real. And I think this desire to make the imagined real was intense with him. And it's the same kind of principle that would lead him to write all those words. He gave me the coin because he wanted to convey to me the extent. It was a way of conveying to a child the extent and the life of his faith, of his Catholic faith, which was extraordinarily important to him. And I think had, you know, he identified very strongly with his mother, and I'm sure you probably know that story. There's been a movie made of it about how his mother died so young, having converted to Catholicism, and then was ostracized by her family, and he saw her as a martyr for the faith. So Catholicism was vitally important to him.
What lessons do you take from his writing that you apply to your own writing?
Well, my grandfather's idea was, which is I've always found rather attractive. I mean, I'm not myself a Catholic, but was that there is an idea called secondary creation, and that when we become secondary creators, when we write a book or we write a novel or something like that, it is the most wonderful. We're kind of fulfilling the will of God. For me, I don't see it like that, but I can see this. I do see the process of creating literature, or creating an imaginary world as a magical thing. And I take it from that. But there's a lot of things that I take from The Lord of the Rings. I mean, The Lord of the Rings, I think just to give you one example relating to the present book, an alternative title for the first of the books was called The Anatomy of Courage, because it's about how somebody decides to be brave and has that instinct, and where it takes them, which is good and bad places. And it certainly makes their life more of an adventure, albeit that it leads to bad places too. And I think that I take that very much from the courage of Frodo and Sam, and the decision to take up that burden and, you know, take it across the world. And The Lord of the Rings is, to me, it's so fabulously worked out. You know, the idea that everything in the world depends on something so small, but that it's something that has to be destroyed, and only the smallest people can destroy it, because in order to get to the place where it is destroyed is right in the middle of the land of Sauron, who won't be able to see you. And the fact that we never see or hear Sauron as well. The incredible idea that the dominant character, the Lord of the Rings, if you like, never speaks. So there are so many aspects to the storytelling and the themes of Lord of the Rings which stay with me and inspire me. It's one of my favorite books and a real source of inspiration.
Just one more thing on your grandfather. We'll get into your books here, but this really struck me as well. You note that your grandfather wrote The Lord of the Rings many years writing without a contract. And that some of the manuscript was written on the back of examination papers he was marking as kind of an extra job, right? So he had his day
Yes, because
job,
he
he had an
had.
extra job, and then he would write long into the night this manuscript that he hadn't sold yet.
I think it's extraordinary the way in which he was able to keep going all that time without a contract and without the knowledge that it was being published. I think the book grew organically, in the same way, kind of way that my book grew. And I feel a kind of closeness to him in the sense of how long it took to write his enormous book. And I think of him in Northmoor Road in Oxford. The house is still there, and you can stand up tall on your tiptoes and look over the hedge, and there's the room, which my aunt so vividly described to me, in which he wrote his work late into the night. I remember her telling me once, a few years back, how he was writing all the way through the morning, all the way through the night, Lord of the Rings, and suddenly he saw lights in the sky and thought that the dawn had come. But actually, it was the bombing over Coventry and the night sky on fire from the German bombers, which really struck me. But I think it was a long, lonely road that he took, and again, indeed, without a contract. And this strange way, which is linked to that, Tom, of how the Lord of the Rings came into being, which I think is absolutely integral to understanding him, and I don't think is talked about very often, although it's universally known, which is that he didn't intend to write the Lord of the Rings. What he was, he wrote The Hobbit, and he wanted the publishers to publish the Silmarillion, and the publishers took a look at the Silmarillion papers and said, this won't work. We want another Hobbit. And it was out of that accident, out of the accident of the publisher saying that they wanted that, that he started a book which was intended to be Hobbit number two, but became quite quickly The Lord of the Rings, an opening out into the Third Age. And that's why we have the book in the Third Age, not because of the accident of the publisher telling him. So I think there was accident, that there was obviously accident involved in the process. And then this long, long process in which, Allen and Unwin, who said they wanted another Hobbit, they hadn't given him a contract. And then at the end, this knowledge that the printing was going to be so expensive that what he wanted was them to publish The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion, and they wouldn't. They would only take the risk on The Lord of the Rings, which had to be cut into three. And then later, he wasn't able, that inspiration that he'd had at the end of The Lord of the Rings, which you see in books like The Fall of Gondolin, to write The Lord of the Rings, it had dissipated and he'd become older, and then it became impossible for him to write it. And I think that this was a shadow over his later years that he couldn't bring it to fruition, and then my father did.
I want to read this one more thing in this essay that you wrote. Speaking of your grandfather, on the eve of publication of the books, your grandfather said, "It would be impossible not to mind what is said. I have exposed my heart to be shot at," which is completely understandable. I wonder if that's how you felt on the publication of your first book, or maybe each book.
I think you do feel that. He wrote that to Rob Murray, who was a friend of mine too. And I think it's, and I think it's very powerful, and it's what you do feel, because if you're an author or writer, you spend all that time alone. In my case, and in my grandfather's case, over many years, and then suddenly you're taking it out into the world and you don't know what people are going to say about it, and it matters terribly. In his case, going back to what we were just saying, Tom, it has quite an effect, because another of the reasons why he got sidetracked is because quite quickly people became extraordinarily enthused with The Lord of the Rings, and then they started writing him endless fan letters about it. And so he was excited, and he wanted to answer, and he wanted to, explain all these things. Sometimes he was thinking about things for the first time, esoteric aspects of Hobbit life or Middle Earth. And I think this sidetracked him from the Silmarillion.
Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the newest two books from Simon Tolkien, The Palace at the End of the Sea and The Room of Lost Steps, about a young man coming of age, crossing continents in search of an identity and a cause at the dawn of the Spanish Civil War. We're talking with Simon Tolkien. We'll have more following this.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in June.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Simon Tolkien. We're talking about his newest books, a historical saga in two books, The Palace at the End of the Sea and The Room of Lost Steps. Simon Tolkien is grandson of J.R.R. Tolkien. He's director of the Tolkien Estate. He's author previously of No Man's Land, Orders from Berlin, The King of Diamonds, The Inheritance, and Final Witness. So, Simon Tolkien, tell us about that first book. Those first books, I guess you write what you know, right? So you were a criminal defense barrister, and it was like, these are crime dramas.
Yeah, we touched, Tom, earlier in our talk about how I came to writing late. I was 40 when I started, and I'd never written a word of creative fiction before then. And so, in order to start, I started where I felt I'd be safe. Well, in fact, I started with writing a novel, a comic novel about a lawyer. And I thought it was great. And back in those days, you would send the manuscript off to literary agents to see if anybody would take you. And I think we've seen in the movie Sideways all the disappointment that you get. And, the replies would come back with the international reply coupon saying, no thanks. Because, being the grandson of J.R.R. Tolkien, I guess got you read, but it certainly didn't get you taken on by a literary agency. And so I wrote a novel, as I think a lot of novelists do, and it wasn't good enough. And that was terribly disappointing. But I think that I immediately, because it had all been suppressed in me so long, I was determined to carry on. And I got some advice, which was to really to stick with what you know and to write about crime. And my first two novels, Final Witness and The Inheritance, they deal that they have courtroom dramas. They're set around a trial. In The Inheritance, there's a guy who's on trial for killing his father and is facing the death penalty in England at that period when the death penalty was just about to go out then. And I think that style of the courtroom drama, which is very stylized, and the language that I was familiar with from the court, from the courtroom, helped me, and it was a kind of prop to get me through. And then afterwards, I threw the prop away because I didn't need it, but I still stayed with crime and what I knew. And then from crime, I started to find that my books were going back in time because I'd always, as a kid, loved history above everything. It was the thing I was really good at. I've got an image of myself as a small boy in my mother's tiny little house outside Oxford with this enormous book that she'd inherited from her father called Haydn's Dictionary of Dates. And if you dropped it on your foot, Tom, it would really hurt. I mean, it was one of these like door stoppers. And, just I would read all the dates and what was happening in the Khanate of the Golden Horde or under Kublai Khan, and my mind would spin, and I loved it. And then later on, I got a little disappointed in history because it was all about why something happened and what the results of it was. And I was interested in the visceral feel of what it would have been like to be on the battlefield and stuff. And I think this love of history and this desire to recreate the past in a visceral way started to come back. And so the King of Diamonds has as a backstory the Holocaust in Belgium. And then The Orders from Berlin is a book about a plot with a mole inside MI5 to kill Churchill. And in that book, I made Hitler and Churchill and Heydrich all come alive. So I was more and more moving towards history. And I then, after that, with No Man's Land, I think the next stage of the development is that I'd been very dependent on plot, ticking clocks, suspense. Pace is really important in novels, Tom, but I'd become dependent on, this has to happen because of that. And very often, characters can become vehicles of plots. And increasingly, I became interested in my characters and I wanted them to be more and more three-dimensional. And so, with No Man's Land, which was set before and during the First World War, a battalion of soldiers who go to fight in that, I wanted to make the characters live. And I felt that was what I was happiest, most happy about it. And I can look back on the characters, Adam and Rawdon and his friends, and they're real to me. So, in the new books, I hope there's pace, but it's very much character orientated. It's the story of a boy growing up to be a man. And as I said before, having adventures because of courage and taking him in many different directions and feeling very confused and feeling very unsure of his identity because just as I was. And so I think I've come to history and character and now the real twin pillars of my writing. And it's a long way to have gone in the last 25 years, really, from where I started.
Yeah, fascinating journey. Understand that, I guess one of the ways in for these books, the latest books, by the way, we're talking with Simon Tolkien. His latest books are called The Palace of the End of the Sea, which is out now and coming out as The Room of Lost Steps. It's all one story. One of the ways in was your learning about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War.
Right.
Tell me about that brigade.
Years before, a long time ago, and I can't even remember where, I read about what it began as the Lincoln Battalion. And the background to this is that during the Spanish Civil War, which occurred before the Second World War in 1936 to 1939, and I think I need to give a tiny bit of background, if that's all right, Tom, in relation to it. The Spanish Republic, as it was called, was a very backward country in which the army and landowners and the church had a great deal of power, and the poor lived in a state of abject poverty and ignorance. And the army and the church and the landowners wanted to keep hold of their power and their land. And there was, after the fall of the monarchy at the beginning of the 30s, periods in which the left, because democracy came in, left won, and then the right reversed that. So what happened in 1936 was that the left won the election by only a small margin. And it was very surprising because the right obviously had the ability to influence votes in a way that the from the pulpit and in other ways that the left didn't. But the left won, and the right decided that they were no longer going to respect democracy. And the army set about a rising, and that rising occurred in July of 1936. And it forms what happened in Barcelona during the rising. The whole, really, of the first part of the Room of Lost Steps is about that. So during the Spanish Civil War, there was, as a result of the army rising, the army gained power in certain parts of Spain, but not in others. And the left, which you have to understand is the existing Republican government, retained power in Barcelona and Madrid and in other places. But they were immediately very much on the defensive because Hitler and Mussolini, who were running fascist governments, supported the Spanish army under Franco. And so there was the spectacle of the Spanish government being attacked by its own army, its democratic government being overthrown because it wanted to bring in progressive policies, Britain and France refusing to get involved, and Germany and Italy, in Germany's case, bombing the hell out of them, and Mussolini sending troops. And I think many people in different, all over Europe, but also in the US, found this intolerable. And so they began to volunteer to go to fight with the Spanish Republic or for the Spanish Republic in order to defend it from the fascists. And this is how the international brigades were formed. And the Lincoln Brigade was one of them. And I read this article, and then I started to read, because the Lincoln Brigade or battalion, when they came back, many of them left accounts, primary accounts, which from a historical point of view are fascinating, which they wrote in the 40s, long out of print, which I was able to get through Amazon from Texas depositories, you know, where they'd sat in dusty shelves for a long time. And they gave a real account of what it was like to fight over there, because they were really used as shock troops. And the second part of the Room of Lost Steps is very much about their experience. But that's how I came to that. And the first part of the Palace at the End of the Sea, which is set in New York, is really trying to investigate why it's not at all about people going to Spain, because it's set long before that. And it starts during the Depression at the beginning of the 30s. But it's about that world of labor struggle and poverty induced by the Depression. And also there's a Jewish dimension, because many of the Lincoln volunteers were Jewish, going to fight because they wanted, the only way in which they could fight Hitler was by fighting in Spain. And it therefore builds the motivation for these 3,000 people who in the late 30s did this extraordinary thing, which is that they gave up their lives in America, they crossed the ocean and arrived in Spain, and many of them died, many of them were grievously wounded. The casualty rate was appalling. And they had this, you know, terrible experience and were defeated. And it also is about the role of the Communist Party, because the Communist Party in different countries, and indeed in America, were the people who organized the International Brigades. And so the whole ambiguity of the Communist Party, which were doing some very good things to help the poor, but which were also under the command of Stalin, who had his own agenda, is also very much a part of these books, is about what communism was and what it really meant and what Theo's, the hero's, experience of it was. I apologize, Tom, that that answer is so long, but in order to try and explain, I didn't want your listeners to think, well, what's all this about, if you see what I mean. And
Yeah,
indeed, in the
definitely.
Room of Lost Steps, I provided a timeline so that people don't get lost in the history, because I think this is one of the reasons why nobody's ever really written a novel about the Spanish Civil War, because the history of which, about which there's a great deal, is so complicated that people have been put off. And one of the things I wanted to do was to try and make it accessible, because I think it's very sad that such an extraordinary war, in which so much happened and in such a visceral way, should not be accessible to historical fiction.
Before we go to another break, when we come back, I want to talk about Theo and some of the other characters. Theo's a fascinating character. We'll talk about the settings. You created a village, Los Olivos, in Andalusia, which seems so real. You set out to do that. A lot of research, I'm sure, to do that. But you say, and this struck my imagination, you say this. The world before the Spanish Civil War in some of these small villages was very much as it was in medieval times. Not a whole
Yes, it
lot
hadn't
changed.
changed. It hadn't changed. When the Lincoln Battalion volunteers arrived, having seen, combine harvesters and stuff in the prairies of America, and they saw how people were using oxen and plows, they were obviously struck by this fact that this was from another time. And the people probably know the Catholic Church had an extremely strong hold on society at that time. And so what was taught in schools was extremely limited, to the extent that there was much education in the villages. So people were living in a state of ignorance. And there was this unbelievable disparity, almost similar to the situation in Russia, I suppose, between the landless and those who owned all the land. And the landless laborers, the braqueros, often were at almost semi-starvation point, because they were only being paid for their labor during the period, the seasonal periods when their labor was needed. So it was a society of extreme social and economic injustice. And the people there had, quite interestingly, in the rural Spain, particularly in southern rural Spain, had turned away from the church and turned to a new religion, which had been spread really by people going on foot from village to village by anarchists, originally by coming from Russia, but then Spanish anarchists. And it had really taken hold as a kind of religion, as an alternative to the church. And Theo's experience of meeting people who were anarchists in the village, and what their beliefs were, is, and his experience later with the anarchists, who were extremely strong in Barcelona, where they ran the big trade union, the CNT, is a big part of the book.
Let's take another break, come back with the final segment with Simon Tolkien. We're talking about his books, The Palace at the End of the Sea and The Room of Lost Steps, and we'll have more following this brief break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in June.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to have with us the author Simon Tolkien. We're talking about his novels, The Palace at the End of the Sea and The Room of Lost Steps. They're both set in America, England, Spain. Young man Theo Sterling is drawn into the Spanish Civil War. Simon Tolkien, tell me about Theo, your hero. What are his What are his biggest characteristics that you wanted to portray?
Well, I've already said that he's courageous. But at the beginning, when the book starts, I think the first words of the book are, he was 11 when he was taken. He was taken by his grandfather, who he'd never met before. And he's taken from his home in, you know, around the area of Washington Square in New York. And he's taken across on foot by his grandfather, great tall man with a huge long beard and a firm grip, all the way through the streets into a completely different part of New York, the tenement land of the Lower East Side, where he discovers during an afternoon that he has a whole Jewish heritage and that his father was Jewish, but that his father had been estranged from his parents and estranged from the Jewish religion because he was starting out in America and he'd married a Gentile, a refugee from Mexico who was a Catholic. And his grandfather wants to tell him about this heritage that he has. And he holds that very strong inside himself, even though his father, when he pulls him out of the apartment, tells him to forget it all, because that's what his father had tried to do. And his father believes in the American dream, which is so powerful. But as the book starts, Wall Street crashes and the Depression begins. And slowly his father's business, which he's built up from a sweatshop to a factory on 7th Avenue, off 7th Avenue, disintegrates. And it's Theo's experience of this, of the disintegration of his father, the disintegration of his father's business, the terrible economic situation of the unemployed in New York, the idea that he's got a Jewish heritage, and his mother's Catholic heritage from the persecution of the Catholics, her parents having been murdered in Mexico, creates a whole crucible of violent emotion and confusion. And I'm coming back to your question here, Tom, mm-hmm. which Theo has to wrestle with, because who is he? Is he Jewish? Is he his father's son? And his father wants him to become a part of Sterling Son. That's his father's new name for himself after he, you know, left his Jewish heritage. Or is he to be part of the Mexican emigre community in New York who spend their time talking in Spanish, just as Theo talks in Spanish about Mexico and the persecution there? Or is he going to have a life of his own, which he begins to have until his father takes it away from him and puts him in the factory, and which later on he begins to have when he has a home with his mother, but then he's taken away from that and then crosses the sea reluctantly, because his mother is going to a completely new country where he's put in an English boarding school with traditions and customs that make absolutely no sense to him. So this is a kid born out of and living through chaos with extreme identity issues, trying to find out who he is and what makes sense to him, and having experiences which in a way somebody that young oughtn't maybe to have. So he's in a sense got ahead of himself in his life, and that makes it difficult. And all the time trying to make decisions about what he thinks is right and what he thinks will be important. And that takes him through many different doors and eventually takes him into the Lincoln Battalion. Mm. As a very young man, he's still only, you know, 18 or 19.
Tell me about, there are a couple of other major characters here. I wonder if you tell me about those briefly. Esmond, his friend, who's a communist, right? And then his love, Maria, who's an anarchist, I believe. And that all of these will end up in the Spanish Civil War on various sides.
One of the problems, and it's quite curious, I want to talk about Esmond, we can come back to it, but he's one of my favorite characters. But one of the problems with a coming of age story, which happens over three continents, is the reader is obviously going, if you write well, to become invested in your characters. But the hero, who's present throughout, because it's a coming of age story, moves. not only through time, but also through space. So how it's very dissatisfying if you leave these characters behind, and you can't have them, Tom, suddenly appear. And you know, this character who was so great in New York, he suddenly runs into him, you know, walking down the streets of London. The reader's going to say, oh no, I'm not having that. It's a coincidence. So you can't have coincidences. There has to be a reason why these characters from before come back. And obviously the Spanish Civil War makes that possible. So that was a real challenge. Esmond is extraordinarily important because I've tried to describe how when he goes to school, what a state of chaos he's in. And Esmond is kind to him, and he hasn't had kindness of that kind for a very long time. And that means a great deal. And also Esmond is funny. He's got a wonderful sense of humor, but also he's a fanatic and he's a communist. But he's able to describe communism in a very appealing way. And Theo has seen how the communists were doing a lot of good things in New York as well. And so Esmond is a very complex character. He's very charismatic, and he has a very strong effect on Theo, who loves him, but also distrusts him. And that becomes a major theme through the book. There was a great play, which was made into a movie with Rupert Everett and Colin Firth, called Another Country, which was set in a boarding school, which was also about a communist and about the experience and what it was like to be in a 30s boarding school in England, which was not an easy experience. They had their own equivalent of hazing going on in those places at that time in a very organized way. And that was very inspirational to me. Esmond's communism, it also becomes interesting later because what his designs for Theo would have been would really have been for Theo to become like another Burgess and Maclean, you know, who were, do you remember the Cambridge spies
Right.
who were recruited and then, you know, got hold of the atom bomb secrets and betrayed them to Stalin and all of that. But Theo refuses to do that. He wants to go to Spain and volunteer. Esmond is named after a character called Esmond Romilly, who was an extraordinary man who volunteered. He was the nephew of Churchill, and he volunteered. He also went to a public school, rebelled against it, and then volunteered to fight in Spain, was involved at the age of 17 in the defense of Madrid, and then eloped with one of the Mitford daughters, came to America, ran a cocktail bar, and then died over the North Sea, having gone joined when the war joined up as part of the RAF. The Royal Canadian Air Force. So Esmond Romilly is the inspiration, but he's, I think, one of the most interesting and fun characters in the book.
I wanted to ask you, just have a couple minutes left here,
I'm sorry,
about
went on.
no, that's fine, that's great. Wanted to ask you about parallels to today. There are obvious parallels. This is a decade of the 30s, right? Idealism and cynicism, hope and defeat, illusion and disillusion. You write democracy versus fascism, haves and have-nots, and the gap widening. I don't know if you thought about that while you were writing this. Of course, it's over 8 years, but
I
and
did
what the
a bit,
parallels are to today.
I feel it's got very strong parallels today. The most obvious and striking one is in relation to the spread of totalitarianism. And what do you do? And going back to what we were just discussing, it's this extraordinary fact that 3,000 Americans were prepared to give up their lives and risk everything and sacrifice everything for the point of view of a cause, the idea of justice, and the idea that democratic countries should not be overthrown by evil dictators. I would think that Vladimir Putin is very much fits the bill in the same way that Francisco Franco did as well. And I think that the book is also obviously preoccupied with what that came out of, which was a period in the 30s of very particularly in Spain, but also in America, of great economic division and social division. So I think all these themes are really important in relation to that time. And the 30s, just as the last word really, are just so extraordinary because we've referred to communism and anarchism and the American dream. It was a period of just unbelievable hope and belief. And Theo's journey is to experience the hope and belief of those isms and where they led him, which is ultimately to disillusionment, which is the same path followed by George Orwell, which climaxes in what to me is probably perhaps the most important book of the 20th century, 1984. And Orwell fought in Spain and had that same experience and came to that conclusion. And now in the world, we see people talking in newspeak. Look at the Russian foreign minister. He is talking newspeak, and the same elsewhere in Iran. This is what we're up against, and Orwell saw it. It's an incredible book, and to me, one of the sort of great books that's ever been written. Written when he was dying as well.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Much else we could say, but go and read the books, the fascinating books. The first one is Palace at the End of the Sea. The second one, with the conclusion of the story, The Room of Lost Steps. The author is Simon Tolkien. You can find him at his website, simontolkien.com? SimonTolkien.com.
SimonTolkien.com, yes, great.
Simon Tolkien, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been a lot of fun. I'm glad that we had so much time, Tom. And thank you for all the interesting questions. And I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks.
Dr. Leo T here. It's One Sky, Many Cultures. Last week's episode, I went comet hunting down in Capitol Reef and spotted the comet Lemon from Panorama Point at Capitol Reef. There's a great horizon all around there at the Panorama Point. And I repeated the trek to the area around Torrey this weekend near Capitol Reef and outside of a small cabin updating the sighting and evolution of the comet as it moves toward the sun, changes attitude and colors a bit. A friend and I got out in the dusk after enjoying the bright, beautiful yellow cottonwoods by Sulphur Creek and the Fremont River, as well as the breeze, the willows, and blue skies. The skies were so clear that we waited in the dusk on a hill for the Big Bear to appear in the north and west and scanned long enough to be rewarded with the fuzzy tail and the head or comma of the comet as we scanned around with the binoculars. Again, between the end of the handle or tail of the Big Bear or Dipper and Arcturus, the orange giant near the horizon, and just above and a bit to the left or the north, as Lemon moves a bit every night. The comet's tail was pointing down to the comma or head compared to last week, the tail brighter and more visible, as well as the head or comma. See the photo on the Skywatcher Leo T Facebook page. I did not take that photo. It's posted there with the credits. I posted it on the 17th, though, and this is a pretty good representation of what we saw, although the photo shows the comma better. Meanwhile, the other visible comet, Comet Swan, is visiting Aquila the Eagle, which is up relatively high in the southwest. The Swan is fading from view shortly. And for more adventure, we swung around to the east and looked at Cassiopeia with its jangly, sparkly DNA strand of star clusters twisting around to a long chain of stars, which over the evening eventually pull up the seven sisters on the end of the strand of stars like a kite on its string. Above this, using Cassiopeia to find it, we saw our neighboring galaxy, Andromeda. The stretch and size of this ghostly oblong puff was amazing but subtle. On the other side of the sky in the south, the moon just above the horizon and the juniper trees and hugging Sagittarius and its clusters and nebula. A fun night of sky exploration from terra firma using our naked eyes and binoculars. And as my friend David Samuel says, the sky and the earth are our heritage. It's what we all have in common. It's ours to honor. And in space exploration history, October 22nd, the Soviet Union's Venera Spacecraft 9 transmitted the first picture from the surface of another planet after landing on Venus 50 years ago. The craft studied Venus's clouds and atmosphere during its descent and measured the surface temperature, pressure, and light level, the equivalent to a cloudy day on Earth. The lander survived for 53 minutes. A separate orbiter became the first craft to orbit Venus, also on October 22nd, 1975, in the way back. And as it is Halloween season, a variable star called Algol gets a nod, as way back was Algol the demon star. Why? Well, Algol is a variable star, meaning it brightens and fades suddenly at times, and at the end of October sometimes brightens significantly. Ooh, The star name Al-Ghul comes from an Arabic word meaning the demon's head, or literally the ghoul. It represents the terrifying snaky head of the Medusa. Why did early stargazers associate the star Al-Ghul with the Gorgon Medusa? It seems some ancients associated the star's variable brightness with the evil winking eye of Medusa. I didn't know it had an evil winking eye, but there it is. Al-Ghul, not to be confused with Al-Ghur, or Beta Persei, is a prominent blue star in Perseus, and not only a variable, but a triple system, so the stars eclipse each other as well. Find Al-Ghul, the demon star in the constellation Perseus, on autumn evenings. Perseus lies below easy-to-recognize constellation Cassiopeia, the W shape. It's fun to watch Al-Ghul brighten and dim. So keep looking out. Look around and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo Teague.